To introduce our three esteemed speakers on optimized pricing. Before I introduce each of the speakers and kind of allude to what their presentations are going to be about, I do want to apologize first and foremost for the fact that we ran out of handouts. Some of you were able to get the set of all three handouts. To the extent you came in a little later and were unfortunate enough not to get a copy, they will be available on the web after the session. Our topic today is optimized pricing. We're going to have three speakers. Claudine Maudlin is going to speak first. She's going to actually be kind of setting the stage for all of you who are kind of wondering what this arena of optimized pricing is all about. And Claudine is a senior consultant with Watson Wyatt Worldwide with over 16 years' experience in the property and casualty insurance industry. She specializes in predictive modeling for rate making and underwriting initiatives, including loss cost analysis, geographic spatial smoothing, retention, conversion analysis, and, of course, price optimization. She is a fellow of the Casualty Actuarial Society, a member of the American Academy of Actuaries, and a co-author of the paper, The Practitioner's Guide to Generalized Linear Modeling. Following Claudine is going to be Alice Gannon, who is going to be able to provide us kind of a company actuary's spin on what optimized pricing means to somebody in an insurance company. And Alice Gannon is a senior consultant with EMB America, LLC, and she has over 30 years' experience in the property and casualty insurance industry. Before joining EMB America earlier this year, Alice was the senior vice president and chief actuary of USAA's P&C Group. Alice is also a past president of the Casualty Actuarial Society and the member of the American Academy of Actuaries. Following Alice is going to be Lee Bowron. And Lee is going to kind of wrap it all up at the very end, kind of giving his spin from his experience on price optimization, in addition to talking about the pros and cons of price optimization, as well as kind of listing out the regulatory issues that might be pervasive surrounding this particular topic. And Lee is an actuary with Kerper & Brown, LLC in Birmingham, Alabama. As part of his practice, he assists companies utilizing the Earnix price optimization software. He has been a consulting actuary since 2001, and prior to that, he was the chief actuary of Permanent General Assurance Corporation in Nashville, Tennessee. Lee has been interested in price optimization for several years and co-wrote an article on price optimization for the CAS Ratemaking Journal in 2001. He is an ACAS, MAAA, and a member on the Committee of Ratemaking. I'd also like to ask everybody to please save their questions for the very end of the presentations. This presentation is actually being audio taped, and so we want to make sure that those who reference this session later can get the full benefit of the presentation, and then the questions will follow. So with that, and no further ado, I'd like to introduce Claudine to the stand.
Thanks, Steve. As the leadoff hitter in today's presentation, I thought I would provide just an overview of what is price optimization. And with that, kind of take a step back and review what the pricing process is for many of us, and perhaps how we might even be considering a lot of the principles of price optimization in our decision-making today. Then I'd like to outline a spectrum of implementation techniques from simple to complex and talk about what some of those may look like in practice. Now, keep in mind, this is a range of techniques. Some of the more advanced techniques we may never see in the U.S. market, but there are several others that might fit very nicely into what we do. My definition of price optimization, and I think this is consistent with what Alice and Lee will present, it's a spectrum of techniques that combines information on loss costs, expenses, and customer behavior to produce a premium tailored to meet a particular business objective. Now, I really want to focus in on that last phrase, tailored to meet a particular business target. This is not a one-size-fits-all solution. It really depends on what it is your company is trying to achieve. Now, the traditional view of profit is to incorporate it in rate making as a flat or a constant loading of premium. Now, we all know in practice, however, if you were to double your premium, you're not necessarily going to get double your profit. It just doesn't work that way. So taking a step back, let's just think about how pricing decisions are made today. And what I've done here is outline kind of a process flow. And what I'd like to do is kind of dissect it piece by piece. So it all starts with how we analyze what drives the cost of claims. Now, companies do this a lot of different ways today. There's one-way analysis, there's minimum bias, there's the use of GLM techniques and other statistical methods. But we as actuaries generally dedicate a lot of time to this initiative. Once we have some indication of what loss cost relativities should be, it's often common practice to compare it to what we charge today. Now, the graph I have here is just a personal lines example showing the effect of one particular rating variable on the cost of claims. The line in red is what a particular company charges today. Those are the current loss cost relativities. The line in dark green is what a GLM loss cost indication suggests we should be charging. Now, a company actuary would be faced with the decision of, do I move away from that red line, presumably in the direction of the green line, but how much? Do I pick an arbitrary value? Do I go halfway from the red line to the green line? Or is there other information I can use to make a more prudent decision? Other information, such as what is the competition doing? So here I have another example, a different rating variable, but now I show the current rate relativities in red, what the loss cost indication is in green, and what the competition is charging in black. Now that may be the rate relativities for a particular competitor, an average of competitors, or actually a model backfit to say the average of competitors, but that gives me additional information in making my decision. You know, in this particular example, suggesting I need to move that red line in the direction of the green line, you know, taking both into account. Now let's switch the focus to expenses. The way we often analyze expenses has been a bit cruder of an analysis than the effort we give to loss cost analysis. Now, expenses could be incorporated in our premium in a lot of different ways. It could be a simple flat percentage loading. It could be a mix of that type of loading, as well as per policy loadings, per claim loadings, or we could even look at expenses in a fully multivariate way. We all know that not every policy is treated equally. Each policy brings a different expense to the table. So if that is incorporated and a model fit to that information, could that be used in enhancing the way we consider expenses in our rate making? Once we have some indication of loss costs and of expenses, we now have this indication of what premium could be. Now, the next logical step in the decision-making process is to compare it to what we charge today. So in this example, I'm just showing a histogram of what band of rate change, or what band of rate change, how many customers would get what band of rate change if I were to go from today's premium structure to what this model indicates I should be charging immediately. It's a pretty wide distribution, right? There's a lot of dislocation that would occur going from current to indicated. Now, in a personal lines environment where we have filed manual rates, what do we normally do to mitigate this? Well, we can make rate relativity selections that are going to bring in that range of customer dislocation, or a more recent trend has been to apply premium moderators or transition rules, saying of my renewing customers, no one will get more than X percent increase, or no one will get more than a Y percent decrease. So those are some recent incarnations. Ideally, we want to be taking into account customer behavior. How does the customer react to a premium change? What other things drive their decisions? It's the same idea as, say, fitting a GLM to your loss cost. We can fit statistical models, say logistic regression, to our historical experience to predict the probability of lapsing, or conversely, the probability of renewing, or the probability of accepting a quote at new business time. Now, in truth, there are a lot of things that drive a consumer's decision. There's how that consumer has been treated by the company in the past, at billing time, at claim time, how loyal they feel to that company or to that distribution channel, what's going on in their life at the time, how price sensitive they are. But what are some of the things that we can actually measure or quantify? Well, I kind of just listed four families here. There's the WHO family, a lot of which we collect today because it's on applications, it's part of our rating variables. Some of it is how do we connect with the customer? How long has the account been with us? How do they pay? What distribution channel was used to bring the business in? What other products do they hold with our company? Then there's the family of what have we done to them, of which the most noticeable circumstance is, well, what rate changes have we given in the past year, in the past 2 years? And then certainly there's what have others done to them, which the most visible example of that is what are the quotes the competitors are providing in the case where the consumer is actually looking for a quote. Here's an example of a lapse model, and this is one of the variables in the who category. So it's all other things being equal, what is the effect of the age of the policyholder on the lapse rate in this personal lines example? So all other things being equal, the younger policyholders are more likely to churn. It's a rather intuitive effect. Here's another example looking at the effect of the price change that was offered to the policyholder at renewal and what was the effect on the retention rate. So you can see as more positive rate increases were offered to the consumer, the retention rate starts to decrease and in fact at one point really takes a nosedive. The other side of the coin says with some of the premium decreases, yeah, there's a little bit of give back in the retention rate, but eventually it actually starts to flatten. Now this is a very tricky variable, and I think both Alice and Lee are going to talk in a little more detail about practical implications, but it's something you'd really want to spend a fair amount of time getting your head around, perhaps looking at it as a spline, perhaps interacting it with other variables. You know, here's the price change interacted with how long the customer has been with the company. You'd want to give caution to how you extrapolate outside the actual range of historical rate changes your company has taken. So this whole idea I wanted to convey in showing this as a process is we do take competition into consideration. We do take dislocation to current rates. We do take elasticity and other retention considerations into account. But perhaps today we're doing it a bit judgmentally, a bit subjectively. What I'm suggesting with price optimization is really building a laboratory to bring a bit more scientific rigor and discipline to this problem. So again, price optimization, a range of techniques that will combine this information on loss cost analysis, expense analysis, and customer behavior to produce a premium tailored to our company's business objective. So let's kind of lift the hood a little bit and look at this in a little more detail. What is it we're trying to optimize? Well, 1 year profit is not necessarily the right measure of customer value. We all know that our renewing customers have lower expenses, may be more tolerant of higher premiums, certainly represent a cross-selling opportunity, so we really need to take a wider view of this solution. Well, consider replacing this constant profit load with a variable profit load that reflects the retention behavior, the propensity to cross-sell, takes into account our organization's global volume targets, and the results of this price optimization is going to depend just as much on those global targets as it is on all these underlying assumptions we're pulling about our loss costs, our expenses, and our behavior. Here I'd like to just build what I call an efficient frontier. I've got a grid here of volume and profit. The dark blue dot represents, for a particular company, for the volume they are currently writing, the overall profit that they are achieving. Now, with price optimization methods, they can actually achieve more overall profit for the same level of volume, so that's just moving vertically, or for the same level of overall profit, they can grow the portfolio with more volume. Now, consider all those different combinations, and you eventually develop an efficient frontier. Now, the company has to decide where on that efficient frontier they want to be. Obviously, the decision is going to be different for, say, a startup company that really needs to build some volume, as opposed to a stable, mature organization that might be interested in maintaining their existing volume or attaining a steady growth rate, but achieving more profit. Add on top of that is there really is no constant efficient frontier, or even if there is some true underlying efficient frontier out there, we're just estimating what it could look like. So as we hone our assumptions, as we refine our models, as we build them, the shape of the efficient frontier may change. For instance, the original one I showed in green may just be when we considered loss costs, expenses, and retention behavior. Well, now if I expand that model to now consider new business conversion or the propensity to cross-sell, the shape of my efficient frontier will change. So the idea here is to construct a model office taking into account all of these known effects. Our company has to decide on what global targets we want to achieve, as well as what individual per policy constraints we want to impose. Then we perform the optimization, and we're not going to go into the technical details of that in this session, but perform the optimization to determine the key parameters. So what does a model office scenario look like? We have some portfolio today. We know over the course of the year, some customers will leave us. Also, some new business will join us. Now, that's a function of many variables, but at the very least, it's dependent on the rates that we're offering in the marketplace, the rates the competitors are offering in the marketplace. But given those underlying models, we can project what we think our portfolio will look like at the end of that year. We'll have an idea of what premium we charged on those customers we believe to be with us at the end of the year. Our loss cost models will give us an indication of what we think will pay out on those customers, and our expense assumptions will give us an indication of what will pay out in that department. So, premium minus loss minus expense, some measure of profit. Now, ideally, you need to also incorporate some value that represents a reward for having some business at the end of that time horizon. Okay, so here I've put plus X dollars per policy in force. So think about it this way. If X were $1 million, you're telling the price optimization algorithm, I want to give a lot of value to having business on the books at the end of the year. So it's going to suggest a very low premium. It wants to go out and get volume, volume, volume. If, on the other hand, you said, let X be a penny, well, it's going to suggest a very high premium because you told it, I don't care that much about, I'm not rewarding for having volume at the end of the year. I really want the value of the profit. Now, you're not really going to tell the algorithm what you think X is. You're going to tell it what your global constraints are. I need volume of 300,000 policies. And it's going to optimize what the reward is for having policies on the book at the end of the year for you. Now, that's just a one-year time frame. You certainly could be doing this over a two-year time frame. Same idea. Now, I would caution about going out 5 years, 7 years, 10 years. There's so much in the marketplace that can change, the underwriting cycle, the competitive environment, et cetera, et cetera. I'm sure you follow that. So, you know, perhaps sticking to a two-year time horizon just feels right. So just talking a little bit about my jargon, targets are global. For example, we need to tell the algorithm, I want to maximize profit subject to some minimum volume of policies. Or I need to maximize volume subject to some minimum profit. Constraints are things we need to impose at the individual policy level. So the most I'm allowing someone's premium to go down, or a minimum dollar of premium, or a minimum dollar of profit, things that we want to make sure the algorithm takes into account at the individual policy level. So a basic measure of profit could just be premium minus claims minus expenses. That's a good, you know, learning how to get into this measure. As you refine the model, you could consider multiple products. You could also consider the propensity to cross-sell. So like many of the other things that are going on in our actuarial community, be it ERM or these types of techniques, you hone these things and you develop them and you refine them over time. You're not going to get there in a day. So I wanted to outline just a spectrum of implementation techniques, and I did actually show the rainbow spectrum here. I'd like to give a few examples, but for purposes of this slide at least, I wanted just to present two different families of techniques. On the left is what I would call scenario testing. So you're literally saying, what if I change rates this way, or what if I change rates that way, run it through your underlying models and see what the resulting volume is expected to be, the resulting profit is expected to be, or any other success criteria you can think of. The right-hand side are really the pure price optimization algorithms, and I'll give a few examples in a few slides. So this first one I've kind of already alluded to. At the simple end of the spectrum, maybe you just want to scenario test different base rate changes. What if I increase rates overall 10%, 15%, 20%, whatever the answer is that you're tinkering with? Well, you can run that through and get different success criteria, the effect on volume, the effect on profit, the effect over different time horizons. Take those all into consideration in guiding your rate-making decision. Same is true when you want to change a few parameters, a base rate change with a few relativity changes, or this idea of applying maximums and minimum caps to the premium at point of renewal. You could scenario test those types of options. What I wanted to spend a little more time on is the other family, which are these pure price optimization techniques. Now, what I'm showing here is just a sample database where each record is a policy, and we've got a lot of information about that policy, a lot of information that was probably used to calibrate the loss models, probably used to calibrate the policyholder retention models. But eventually, we're going to run an optimization algorithm, and for each record, that algorithm is going to give us an optimal premium for that record in such a way that it meets our overall global targets, so for instance, a minimum volume target, and also takes into consideration those per policy constraints. So that's our optimal premium. Now, again, in the lines like personal lines, where you do need to file an actual manual rate, could you backfit a GLM to that field and basically reverse engineer what a rating plan would look like? And that's what this output is showing. So it's similar to the graphs I showed earlier. The line in red is what we charge today. The line in green is what the loss cost model indicated we needed to be. And remember before I said, well, how do we decide where in that band to move rates? You know, do we pick an arbitrary amount? Do we consider competition? To what degree can we consider policyholder behavior? That's what the pink line is showing. It suggests, for reasons of profitability, your best choice was not going all the way to the green line. It was going, in this instance, you know, what appears by eyeballing it, perhaps two-thirds of the way. Now, in a line of business where you don't rely solely on manual rates, what could you do with that field of just optimal premium? Okay, not having to backfit it into a GLM structure to produce a manual set of rates. In my mind, this is a great application in the commercial lines because this becomes a benchmark. Right, the commercial lines have a lot more wiggle room in terms of here's the manual rate, but there's a lot going on at point of sale with scheduled credits and debits and things like that. This can become the benchmark, you know, providing a little more discipline in how much wiggle room should actually be taken, in what direction, and with what magnitude. By the way, this is what's being done more in the unregulated markets in the UK and Europe, where pricing schemes are actually rolling out, where the algorithm of the pricing scheme is a function of one variable, the policy number. Because in the back room, you fit your optimization algorithm, and you now know for policy A, B, C, you should be charging this amount. Now, obviously, for new business and for endorsement activity, you may need to fit a model to this to come up with some structure to generate a new business rate, but you know that's what's being done. Taking it even further in terms of what's being done in the unregulated markets is a dynamic point-of-sale individual optimization. So premiums are determined at the point of sale in a real-time sense. The inputs include the most up-to-date market conditions, so competitive position and elasticity information, and basically results in identical customers potentially getting different premiums. So this is a bit more of what we think of as going on in the airline industry and the hotel industry and, you know, these pricing schemes that are heavily dependent on things like price elasticity. So the last thing I'd really like to say is these obviously follow the GIGO principle, the garbage in, garbage out. The assumptions, the targets, and the constraints will drive the answer. Now, this, as actuaries, shouldn't scare us. Everything we do, to some degree, relies on the GIGO principle, right? We have to make assumptions and make decisions in light of uncertainty. But the optimization process is really going to ruthlessly exploit any error in your underlying assumptions. So an error such as when you're considering price elasticity in your retention model, how did you extrapolate outside the range of those rate changes you have actually taken? Okay? Or, you know, how good are your loss cost models? Or how accurate, you know, is your information on the competitive position? Okay? So it's important sensitivity test your assumptions. If you rely on this, either in a benchmark situation or anything more, to monitor the actual experience against the expected experience. So really, this is a laboratory, a benchmark, an additional tool in our toolkit to help us make more disciplined pricing decisions. And I think I just want to kind of finish my part of the presentation with almost a personal story. You know, I started my actuarial career at Allstate in the 90s doing rather traditional state pricing in a personal lines environment. I then worked for AIG overseas. I worked in Japan, and for that particular entity, they had never had an actuary on board before. They were kind of managing the ship based on calendar year results. So I went in and did an overall rate level review. I looked at the rating plan, relativities, and, you know, basically went to my boss, the CEO, and said, here's what I recommend needs to change. Would you like to sit down and review my trend assumptions and loss development and why the rating plan needs to be tweaked? And the response I got was kind of like, God, no. You know, sounds kind of dry and boring. But what I'd really like you to tell me, Claudine, is if we take this rate change you are recommending, what's going to be the effect on the retention? What's my volume going to look like in a year? What's going to be the effect on my loss ratio in 1 year, in 2 years? And, you know, here, I'm a brand new fellow. I'm 20-something years old. I kind of sat back and said, you can't ask me that. But you know what? He could, and he should. And we should be kind of retooling and thinking about those types of questions. Because in his mind, why would you ever take a rate change if it didn't make sense, you know, in his portfolio? So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Alice.
Great. Well, her personal story is a great lead-in to my early slides. As Steve mentioned, he asked me the onerous task of taking a company actuary perspective, and I decided to, okay, be nice and agree. Of course, the fact that I spent 31 years as a company actuary and I've spent about 4 months as a consulting actuary, this wasn't real onerous. It was with great relief when he asked me to take a somewhat different perspective than he assumed the other two presenters would take. What I want to do, and which button do I hit to, what's the best way to, is to take the company actuary perspective. I'll have a little bit of background information. There is a little bit of overlap in our three presentations necessarily, but Steve did a great job of minimizing that for us. And then mainly talk about the inputs into a price optimization process and the challenges as a company actuary that you'll identify, you'll experience as you take that journey, and advice that I would give having experienced this. Stepping back, and as Claudine gave in her example, is we need to remind ourselves what the pricing function is all about. Price is a key lever in the overall performance of our companies and of any company with virtually any product, right? And our real objective as pricing actuaries is to come up with the prices that can best support our corporate goals and objectives and our overall business strategy. And that's both financial goals and market performance goals. It's also both short-term goals and long-term goals. And as we all know, what makes this interesting and challenging is the fact that there's tension among those goals. What's best set of prices for financial results in short-term may not be the best set of prices for market performance long-term. So, we always need to keep that in mind. Now, with that said, I wanted to reflect a moment on how our industry, how pricing actuaries have done in improving in that over the 31 years that I've been involved in pricing. And I'm primarily, well, strictly a personal lines perspective, but I'm sure there's applicability on commercial lines. First of all, I would say as pricing actuaries, We have made tremendous progress in those 31 years, not all by ourselves. A lot of it's been technology and improvements and data and all of that, in being able to come up with good predicted, for the pricing time period, aggregate loss costs. Now, sometimes top management won't always go along with that. We do still experience some underwriting cycles and that kind of thing. But we have made great progress, and I think overall do a really good job here. Always room for improvement, but we've come a long way. With regard to granular loss costs, we've also made great improvement throughout that time period. Most recently in the United States, the use of generalized linear modeling has made tremendous progress in that. Still a lot of work to be done, but we've done, as a profession, I think a really good job at improving in those things. Understanding and knowing our price competitive position, a lot of great work has done, and I don't think we can be faulted on that, but we've worked hard on both sides of that in terms of we've developed great tools, great ways of going and getting information, better ways of thinking about it and measuring it and aggregating it, but also as companies, with a lot of help from others, we find better and better ways of hiding that information from our competitors, of making more things in our underwriting rules that may not be public information, or of making our pricing rate manual so complicated nobody can read them, that kind of thing. And so I would not say that today that we are any better at knowing and understanding our competitive price position than we were 31 years ago, because we've worked so hard and so effectively on both sides. The two areas that I think as a profession we have not done a very good job of in working over the 31 years is, first of all, in really understanding policyholder reaction to price. That's the customer demand, the price elasticity side. Recently, we've been getting better at that, but a lot more work needs to go on that. And finally, in bringing it all together, all of the considerations, knowing that our objective is to support the overall corporate goals and strategies, bringing it together efficiently and systematically as opposed to just a lot of gut feel and judgment. The good news is that in price optimization, as was well defined by Claudine, you're really addressing those two areas where I think as a profession we haven't done enough. First of all, you have to have the price elasticity models to do a price optimization process. And while that's not the whole answer to customer behavior, it certainly is a big piece in better understanding the customer reaction toward price. And then finally, the price optimization models themselves are a way of systematically and efficiently bringing together all the different considerations in coming up with the best prices to support the corporate goals. Now, just a few words on what price optimization is not, because when I started talking about this concept at my prior employer, I got a lot of this kind of thing. First of all, it absolutely is not a replacement for pricing strategy. Pricing strategy is part of your overall business strategy that needs to be developed. What it is, it's a better way of implementing that, and as you're working with better tools, it may help you formulate that strategy better because you'll have clearer information. But it doesn't replace. It's not that you as the pricing actuary will come up, okay, here's our pricing strategy. It is something that will have to be developed broadly within the organization. It also, it could be, but it certainly won't be if it's done properly, exploitation of your loyal customers. I would argue that both because of regulation and because of fairness, we will always want to stay within an actuarially sound range for the rates that we select. Now, as we all know, because we're pricing prospectively, there is some range even around the aggregate total rate level, but there's a pretty broad range of actuarially sound rates when you get to a highly granular level. And so that's, I think, more work on that actuarially sound range will be needed. And I'm not going to tell you exactly how to peg that, though there are some techniques to be used that are out there. But you're going to need to develop what you think is and can support, with whatever regulatory theory you're going to need to support it, the actuarially sound range of rates. And then you can select freely within that based on other considerations. It's also not a multi-year pricing plan. Doing price optimization does not mean you don't have to review rates as often as you did before. If anything, you may want to review them more frequently. And it's also not a matter of blindly trusting a black box. Claudine made that point also. There is still a definite need for a lot of judgment and a lot of risk control processes. Okay, why would any company want to pursue a price optimization? Well, for one thing, the capability now exists. and there's competitive pressure to do so. The business reality is virtually all of our companies want profitable growth. The reality is that there are increasing costs associated with acquisition of new business. We have data, we have computing power, we have wonderful statistical tools that make this feasible. There continues to be, and I would suspect will be for some time, a scarcity of excellent technical pricing resources, like many of us in the room, and therefore we need to be sure that we're equipping our good technical resources with the best possible tools. And your competitors are pursuing, to some extent, price optimization. So the benefits, of course, is you can increase your profit, or you can increase your volume, or you can increase both. Efficient frontier, as Claudine was explaining, you can maximize your current value of your current portfolio as well as your new business flow and the trade-offs between those. You can for sure increase the effectiveness of your marketing message if you're working collaboratively with your marketing area and the results from here, which I'd encourage you to do. If you're a company that has multiple distribution channels, you can align strategies for both of those much more effectively. There's all kinds of reasons why this is a good idea, but bottom line is, if your competitors are doing it and it's good, then you're going to get behind if you don't, and the only way to counter it is to stay up it. And if they're not doing it, great, you can get ahead of them and you have that competitive advantage. Now I want to move into, there are basically five inputs into the price optimization process, and talk a little bit about some challenges associated with those. The first one, of course, is the estimated loss cost. And I said earlier, I think we've made good progress on that, both in the aggregate level and in the detailed level. So we won't spend a lot of time on this. It's not really coincidence that Claudine and I both use the term ruthlessly exploit the errors. We both heard it from the same other actuary. But it resonated with both of us, obviously, and we both used it, because it is a great term. When you get to the final full price optimization that is a systematic approach, kind of the ultimate in scenario testings where it's going through hundreds of thousands and picking the best, it may be more difficult to identify something that you really didn't feel that confident about in the loss cost input. So you need to make those judgmental fixes to your estimated loss cost. You know, in the curve here, obviously, we're a little less confident about the point estimate at the far end of that range where there's very little data. Those yellow bars indicate the amount of data. Now, there's a huge range around that, and maybe you're not comfortable with putting that whole range in the model that, okay, you can put any price within that range and it's actuarially sound and has some reasonable chance of generating the profit level that we want. You may not be comfortable with that. I wouldn't be. So you may want to go ahead and judgmentally narrow that to whatever bias you have. Those of you, how many of you were here at the session that was in this room right before this session on behavioral finance? Yeah, all of that stuff definitely relates to this, and this is kind of the narrow pricing application trying to bring in those behavioral aspects of all this. So as they said before, a lot of judgment is still needed in making good decisions, and the decision-making process is key. Now, the second major input is the competitive position. Critical that you have good measures of your competitive position, because price elasticity is very dependent on that. You can have an example. If you are super price competitive, then if you're just looking at price elasticity based on, okay, I move the prices up a little bit, let's see what happens. Does retention go down at all, or how much does it go down, or does my close rate go down? And you see it doesn't move, and you assume their price, these people are price inelastic, right? Well, they're price inelastic because, yeah, they may be irritated you raise their rates and they may go and shop, but you're so price competitive they can't find a better deal. So it's not that they're price inelastic. They may be very price elastic, but hey, you're the best deal in town. So you've got to know what your competitive position is. And the other is true. You may be super uncompetitive and you think, okay, I'm going to cut my rates 10%. I ought to really see improvement in retention and in close rate, and it doesn't improve. Well, that's because you're still super uncompetitive. You know, you're better than you were, but you're still uncompetitive. And those kind of things do happen usually. I mean, if you're still in business, they're probably not happening in major ways across your book of business, but you want to get as refined as you can. So for some narrow market segment, you may be super competitive or super uncompetitive, and you don't want to misjudge the elasticity of that segment because you haven't put into the model this accurately. Now, I would argue it's easy to get lots of competitive information. It's real hard to get a thorough, accurate, and timely competitive position. price optimization, I don't think, would requires us to do a lot more than we're doing today if you're already a well-run company, because all of us are probably taking competition into account a lot now. Now, the problem might come into is you really haven't zeroed in on how you want to measure competition. Maybe you measure it in several different ways, and you're kind of just doing a judgmental weighting across those. You're going to have to get a little more rigorous in the math on that into what you put in your model. So whether you're pegging it as, let's say you zero in on your four top competitors, and you're super competitive if only one of them is cheaper than you. If you're cheaper than three of the four, and you're okay competitive if you're in the middle of the pack, or however you want to define that, that's fine. Maybe that's one thing you look at, and then you also look at what's my price compared to the average of those four, or the average of the two that I think are the most important. Whatever those approaches are, there's a lot to be, I mean, we could spend a whole session just on that. But what you've been using, you can probably still use here in this environment, unless you haven't pegged it mathematically, in which case you're going to have to do that. I would say, and I'll do another slide on that, the competitive position is even more important on new business than it is on renewal business. And the obvious reason for that is that an awful lot, just go ahead and build this all up. The obvious reason for that is a significant portion of your renewal book isn't going to shop, isn't going to know whether you're price competitive or not. Claudine already covered it a lot, so I won't go into it in much detail. But there's a lot of the first thing in the renewal side is, are they shopping? And are they shopping because you did something to them? Are they shopping because the competitors did something? Are they shopping because some life change, you know, they moved or they added or deleted a car, whatever that is. And so, but it, you know, isn't it wonderful for us that we have this huge inertia in a large part of our book? And part of our objective is to try to keep them forever finding out that, you know, you may not be price competitive. But once they do are irritated by something, or there's a life change, or, you know, the Geico gecko got to them or whatever, and they decide to shop, then, of course, price competitive position becomes important. But even then, it's not as important. A brand, I would suggest that most brand new business coming to you, their number one criteria for purchasing is going to be price. I would say on most of your renewal book, even those that are driven to shop, price may be far down on the list. They may be shopping because they didn't like your claim service. And vice versa, if you have an insured who had a good claim experience with you recently, you can probably triple their prices and they're not going to leave because they had a good claim experience. And so they know you give them good claim service and they don't know that about any other competitor. And they have a recent memory of how traumatic all that was and want to stick with that good claim service. Maybe tripling is a little extreme. But though some of them, you could even do that. Not that you would, of course. So we then get to the third major input, which is the price elasticity model. And as I said, one of the major components of that is certainly on price competition. But the reason you need customer price elasticity models in price optimization is to predict the renewal retention rate and the new business conversion rate at any given price and at any given price change on that. So you want to be able to predict that. And these are largely constructed from statistical analysis of the historical behavior of your customers purchasing. It's important to remember, you shouldn't talk about, okay, policyholder X has elasticity Y. It's not a single point. It's a curve, and it changes along that curve. And customer X maybe have one level of price elasticity at your current competitive position at your current price for auto, and a completely different one for homeowners. Overall, homeowners' customers tend to be less price elastic. For sure, those who their insurance is just kind of buried in their escrow anyway, and what they're, you know, feeling the pain of is as their interest rate changes on their mortgage. So they may not even know what their price is or notice how it might change. Or you could have a totally different competitive position. Or if it's a homeowner customer in a hurricane-prone area, they're just delighted that you're still writing them because they read about how, or they hear from their neighbors about your competitors are all non-renewing major parts of their business. So it's not this human being has this level of price elasticity. It's all relative within the context of the product and what they're experiencing and what their perceptions are with that product. Anybody who studied price elasticity theoretically knows that the way to do it right is to do lots of price testing, and that's absolutely true. when I first started talking to some people in our economic research area about that, I said, okay, well, what's our price testing plan going to be? Well, we can't do price testing. You may can do a little bit of it, just within that range, if you're willing as a company to stick your neck out on that. But even if you don't do any price testing, okay, you have what you have. That doesn't negate that this could still be a value-adding approach. Because you're going to change rates for other reasons, and that gives you valid information that you can plug into, and you can build price elasticity models. Now, the range of that price elasticity model, you're probably not, you know, except in those unusual situations, raising people's rates 50% or cutting them 50%, so that part of the range may be real iffy, and you may not want to even use that within that. But some part of that range, but you've got to start collecting that data. Unless you have the unusual capability of going back and getting a lot of accurate history, which most of us can't, or if we can't afford to do it, even if it were physically possible, you have to start collecting that data. So even if you didn't think that your company was ready to launch into a price optimization project anytime soon, I would encourage you to start capturing the information you would need to build price elasticity curves. It's valuable information for other reasons as well. Here is a slide of a real example. This happens to be a UK motor vehicle company that gave us permission, a project that my EMB did. And I just want to use it to point out a few things. It's a little bit similar to what Claudine showed you. In this case, what we have, and you don't need to worry about the values because they're actually not right, but at the bottom is just the rate change, and that big red vertical line is zero rate change. You didn't change their premium at all. And then obviously as you move to the right, those are rate increases, and you move to the left, rate decreases. And the segmented the market into first renewals, that business that you have that were renewing for the first time, second time, and third time, just showed those three, though you could have others. And then what the retention rate does. And it's no surprise, as you raise rates, the retention goes down for all three of those groups. As you lower price up to a point, the retention goes up. But it's interesting how you cut them more, it goes down. That's the first thing I'll point out. That's a fascinating phenomenon. I've seen that many times. And it screams to be explained. I can't prove to you why that is. There's various theories. The theory that I like the best is, you know, you cut rates 30%, and the policyholder knows that. I said, well, have they been gouging me all mm-hmm. this time? And that motivates them to kind of look around a little bit. And maybe the reason you cut their rates 30% is because you had been gouging them all this time. Not intentionally, of course, but, you know, just one of those accidents that happens. And so sure enough, they can find a cheaper rate. So that's the phenomenon. That's the theory I like the best, but I can't prove that, and there could be others. But you'd want to investigate for sure to make sure that data's right. The other thing could be is that part of that elasticity curve is for a very unique set of people where, indeed, you've been gouging them, you know, and you've cut rates a lot. And so they were already getting kind of mad at you anyway and would have, you know, that kind of thing. So you need to dig into your data. And it may be that in your optimization you would want to adjust that curve for some reason, or even lop that part off and say, okay, we're not going to be cutting anybody's rates 30%, so let's not even consider that, at least in the price optimization's systematic approach. Then you may also question, it's no surprise that the first renewals have lower retention than the second renewals, the third renewal's a little better, but the gap between all of those, I would say if this is your first attempt at this, you're going to want to look in to all of those points and kind of get a feel, okay, where is the data good and where is it not? What do I believe? Why would the reasoning be for that? And get some level of comfort that that's true and valid. Now, if you'd been working on this for, you know, 10 years and, you know, you're updating this every quarter, every 6 months, and you keep seeing this consistent pattern, even if you hadn't explained it, at some point, you know, it keeps happening so regularly, you come to believe it anyway. But one way or the other, you've got to come to believe it, I think, before you would really want to take it to the bank in terms of changing prices based on that, and certainly before you could really convince others within your company to go along with that, with the extreme price change aspects. As with loss costs, just the point I just made, good judgment's going to be needed in analyzing and modifying your elasticity models. And so I encourage you, bring anybody in your organization who might have insight into customer behavior. It's really important to not think that you as the actuary really are the best psychologist and social behavioralist or all that at your company. Good chance you're not, and certainly no one person or no one department would be. So try to develop a good collaborative relationship with others in your company who can help bring insight into the customer behavior aspect so you can know what data to trust and what not to. As well as you're working on this, you may find areas of price sensitivity that one way to address it is to change the price in some way, or maybe your company needs to find ways to make that group less price sensitive. I'll give you an example of that. Something that I was surprised to find is that there's relatively high price sensitive compared to other points at when someone is adding and deleting a car. Okay, you kind of think about that. All right, maybe that makes sense. All right, well, what can we do with that? Can you cut rates at that point and then somehow gradually get them back up later? And they go, well, that might not work. Maybe what you need to do is look at why are they price sensitive there? And I would suggest to you that one explanation would be because you don't have a real good process for letting them add and delete a car. It's a friction point for them. They're not happy with that. And so you're motivating them by that bad service experience to go shop. And if you can just fix that, they won't shop, and that perceived price sensitivity will go away altogether. A lot of times when you look at that, or I'll take another example. You've just added your first 16-year-old to your driver's policy. Whoa, even when I did that, and I was in charge of auto pricing, and I knew it was going to be a big number, got that first bill, it is shocking. I mean, whoa, that's a lot of money. And so that's a natural time to shop. You're going to be more price sensitive just because suddenly your automobile insurance may have doubled. But so maybe what you need to do is work at making, if you really want to keep that market, rather than heavily subsidizing 16-year-old drivers, that may be not something you want to do, maybe you need to reduce the price sensitivity by appealing to the other things that a parent really cares about, and that is, okay, how can I make sure my kid doesn't kill himself and others in his first year of driving? And so you've seen wonderful automobile insurance companies develop programs to help parents with that. And that kind of program and that kind of support and that kind of empathy with what they're facing may overcome any desire to switch to a lower competitor who may not offer those kinds of support, or they may offer them, but they're not perceived by the customer of offering them. So often solutions, things that you uncover in doing price elasticity work, will be things that you won't want to just fix through optimized pricing, but you may, as a company, even more effectively be able to address by, okay, let's make them less price sensitive here. Okay, the next input is you have to put in here what your company's objectives are. And I would suggest to you, my experience has been, this may well be the hardest part and the one of most value beyond even the pricing function. Okay, that sounds kind of weird. Virtually all of your companies have stated profit and growth objectives, I suspect, at a high level. Many of your companies may also have some sub-objectives under that. Here's the underwriting profit I want, but here's how I feel about it, or my objectives by state, or by region, or by market segment, or by something else. Some of those sub-objectives may not be stated, or they may be, everybody knows about them, but they're not quantified. You have got to get them explicitly stated and some agreement as to the mathematical value of those. And an example I'd use, let's say that through marketing or whatever, you've segmented your book of business into 10, 15, 20, 50 different market segments. Good chance you like some of those market segments better than others. Your business strategy is we're going to be really good and have deep penetration in these markets, happy to deal with these others, but they're relatively less important to our strategy for whatever reason, whether that's a financial reason, whether that's a marketing strategy reason, whatever. But you almost certainly have some different fields. I mean, my prior company certainly did. I'm sure yours do. You've got to get after that, and then you're going to have to quantify the trade-off. Preferred market segment A. Would I be willing to give up one of those, i.e. raise the rate so that the retention dropped a little, if I could get my retention rate improved or new business improved by how much for a less preferred, and I don't mean preferred in terms of profitability, but a piece of my market segment that I don't love as much or care about, is not as important to my business strategy? Is it one? It's certainly not one for one. Is it one? If I can get two of those, I'll give up one here. 5, 10, 100? And going through that exercise at your company is going to open the eyes of everybody, and you may have vicious debates about what that is, but it'll be important for your company, if not to nail it to the ground. Okay, exactly 3.2 of those is what that is. But okay, is it 2 or 3, or is it 10 or 11, or is it 50, or is it none? I'm never willing to give up one of those to get these. That'll be important for your company to know in other decision-making that they're going to do. And this process will help you do that. Now, what if scenarios, often you can ask that question, you even ask it of the ultimate decision-maker, whether that's the CEO or the board of directors or some senior management team, and they may think they know the answer, and they'll say it, but then when they actually see scenarios and the full way that plays out and the implication, oh, well, I didn't mean that. You know, I'm really not willing to give up one of those to get two of these. No, that really, because, you know, here I'm giving up 10,000 of those to get 20,000 of those. No, that's not good. That kind of thing. And so you're going to have to do a lot of scenario testing and laying that out and making sure you're communicating clearly those full implications before you take it to the bank and start making significant price changes based on this approach. Constraints, Claudine already talked about that. That's, of course, very important, too. There are some universal constraints. I'm sure, certainly it's consistent with all of our highly ethical companies that we want to be legal and we want to be regulatory compliant. So those become, various circumstances, universal constraints, immovable. And there may be corporate constraints. It may be that, wow, this is so cool, you could grow 20% more policyholders next year. Well, but it would crash your ability to service them and to do the claims handling. You have operational constraints. So let's go after, you know, a little less growth and a little more profit then if we've got that much opportunity out there. So there may be some, or there may be just corporate mindsets. We absolutely are not willing to raise rates that much for any group of people, or we absolutely are not willing to take that much financial risk, or whatever that is. And then there'll be local constraints, and those are more likely to change frequently and as you go through this process. With regard to the maximum changes, it may be they think, well, no, of course, we don't want to raise anybody's rates more than 25%. But then if you show, well, you know, this set of people, there's room within the actuarially sound range to really raise them. They aren't price sensitive. What they're really valuing is a great service that we're providing. They experience claims. We did a terrific thing. Why not raise their rates 30%? We're not going to lose a one of them, you know, kind of thing. And with that, we'll be able to do a lot of cool things for these other people who staying within the actuarially sound range. We now will have the opportunity to show them what great service we can deliver to them. So you may change your mind or the mind as that all plays out. So in summary, In summary, price optimization definitely can dramatically improve a company's financial and growth goals in whatever combination of that you want to do. There are big challenges, and I would encourage you not to let those challenges intimidate you. This does not have to be textbook perfect to add great value. Don't let the perfect get in the way of the good. Marginal improvement. It should be a relatively slow path because of a lot of things I told you and some uncertainty and lack of data at certain levels of the price elasticity, but I encourage you to launch on the path. And I would say while pricing actuaries should lead this effort, it will be most successful if it's collaborative with a lot of other people because you're getting into territory where actuaries are not the expert. Maybe nobody is the expert on the human behavior side, but certainly, and there's even more reason to get as many perspectives and as many opinions on the table and work that out. And that's what I have.
Thank you, Alice. I'm going to pick up on some of the themes, go in a little more detail about regulatory impacts. But starting off, I you know, this was from a recent newspaper article. Can you hear me? Starting off from a recent newspaper article, they were saying that insurance executives say insurance pricing weakness is the biggest risk their industry faces in the next few years. So I think what we're seeing is that our boss, if you're a company actuary, that your boss is concerned about pricing, and they're concerned about, you know, irresponsible pricing. Of course, one company's perception of irresponsible pricing might be another company's volume maximizing optimized price. So, but I think there is some concern on that, and I think, you know, price optimization is a tool that can be used to mitigate that. And we've talked about this, but just basically, the left side is sort of how actuaries have traditionally thought, and that is that, you know, you're going to put in a loss ratio, a risk cost, you're going to add in your expenses, you're going to put in an underwriting profit, you know, and that's sort of how you think of prices. But when the customer looks at prices, they're looking at it like they look at anything else, and they're looking at all the typical marketing things, the advertising, the brand, you know, their claims experience has been mentioned, just various points. Their relationship with an agent is critical. So it's just a different scenario. And I think that really comes to play on renewals. We've talked a little bit about that. But in a little more detail, basically what you find is that for almost all lines, the more tenure, the more years you have a customer, the better the loss ratio is. But the problem is that, and so you might be tempted when you look at the rates to say, okay, well, they've got lower loss ratios, let's give some sort of loyalty discount. And companies out there do that. Although I would argue that very few companies give the sort of full indicated discount for renewals based on the cost. But what happens is that switching, you have a relationship, but there's also the cost to the consumer. Switching is hard on personal lines. I mean, you have to go out and you have to dig out this deck page and call up people. I mean, it's a much easier scenario to pay the bill. So what happens is that, you know, the renewal ratio remains high for most companies because there's value in tenure. There's value to the consumer for that relationship to the company, for that company to continue to have their information and to continue that relationship. That's not necessarily true for an airline where, you know, just because you flew Delta last week doesn't mean that it's going to be any easier to fly Delta than United this week. So it's a different scenario. We've gone over demand modeling. But what I would say, and Claudine mentioned this too, is that, or actually Alice, that really what you want to do is you want to start getting the data now. If you're just thinking about this, you may want to go back and begin collecting the data. And the renewal offer is, you know, run into several companies, work with several companies, and for some reason, these systems, they seem to calculate this renewal offer. In other words, 30 days before a policy expires, you know, the computer goes in at night and it says, oh, okay, this will be your premium for the next term, and it calculates the renewal offer. There may have been a rate change. It may age on personal auto. It may be aging the driver. The driver's 1 year older, you know, and so you're going to capture that. It's going to maybe look at their vehicle record and charge an accident or something like that, so the price may change because of that, and the credit score may be updated. I mean, those are just sort of different variables that tend to update on renewal offers, and then, of course, the pricing that's effective at that point. And so they calculate a price that gets sent out, and, you know. And the problem is that a lot of times when that price is sort of calculated and sent out, it just sort of disappears. And then you do have information, of course, you can sort of go in and see whether they renewed or not. But it's sometimes worth mentioning. And so see if you're really keeping your renewal offers. Of course, demand modeling is totally different from your business and renewals. And you know, as we've mentioned, probably the biggest difference when you go and look at demand modeling, what I've seen is that, you know, the biggest variable, not surprising, is going to be the amount of the rate change. That's going to have the biggest impact on whether somebody renews or not. The sort of traditional class plan variables, they're going to have, what I've seen is that they are going to have more of an impact on your new business, and they may have some. Now, I don't know exactly what that relationship will be. It's not necessarily going to be the same relationship as you're seeing on the loss side. But those type of variables, the age, sex, marital status, where you live, you know, those can be significant. It just tends to be a little more significant on new business than renewals, and what I've seen. And we mentioned claims, and actually, I've seen examples in the UK where people have claims and the rate goes up. Well, the rate doesn't go up because they had a claim and they are now a riskier driver. You know, their risk of future claims is going up. It's going up because they're inelastic and their optimized price is higher. And you can see that actually that may be. And various things. You can see this. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on these because we have gone over these renewal curves. And I want to give plenty of time for questions. But when you talk about optimization, really what you're talking about is that you've got this objective. And you know, what is optimization? And a lot of people think, well, optimization is just gouging people or maximizing profits or something like that. But really, and we talked about that, it's really just defining an objective and then, you know, having a condition. So when we looked at a thing, it's, you know, okay, what's the most volume I can write at my current profit level? Or what's, you know, the other common one is how much profit can I make at my current volume level? And or you can also introduce retention. You can constrain it on volume, retention, profit, lifetime value. So let's talk a little bit about lifetime value, because I think that's kind of the holy grail of where this is going. I'm not sure that many companies are there yet, but really when we talk about constraints, we're talking about pricing and we're saying, oh, okay, well, let's get our best prices at our current retention rate. But what you need to be thinking about moving to is, you know, really pricing toward what's the lifetime value of the risk. And that's easy to explain, but it sometimes is pretty hard to implement. Because, and I'll just give a simple example, you know, if you're doing a lifetime model on personal auto and you've got a 25-year-old single male and they buy a liability-only policy, what you're trying to say when you do a lifetime value, there's sort of a wide range of things that could happen. This 25-year-old might eventually buy a nicer car and get full coverage. And they might get married and stay with the company and bring their spouse with them. And they might buy a home. And then, you know, at that point, you might could even cross-sell some life insurance. So, you know, here's an example. Obviously, you know, the average 25-year-old single male is not going to develop that kind of relationship with the company. But at the same time, there's that probability that that could happen, whereas for, a 55-year-old male, that kind of, you know, relationship isn't, you know, lifetime value won't be there. So, you know, how do you bring that into an optimal pricing scenario? You know, I think that's a challenge. We talked a little bit about this. Really, optimization in some ways is defining this objective function and really simply using calculus to sort of find the point on the function where you're hitting your, subject to the constraints, you're hitting that maximum point, maximum profit, maximum retention. Now, they don't really use derivatives. They use, you know, most of the software is using different mathematical techniques, which are beyond my ability to explain, but it's still, that's the basic concept. I mean, that's the concept is various sort of functions and finding those points through sort of derivative type techniques to get to that optimal point. So let's talk about optimization. What are some of the arguments against it? And I think one argument, which is a reasonable argument, is that you're getting away from expected cost. So you might lose some of your pricing discipline. If you go out and you start doing, well, you know, we want to do optimal pricing here and you know, start charging different things than your cost, you can sort of lose that kind of focus. And I think as actuaries, we've done a good job of zeroing in on costs and being able to sort of, you know, get a lot of value out of our class plans and refine our class plans and being able to, you know, refine that and understand costs better now than we ever have. On a line like personal auto, but and this, you know, even if theoretically this could still be done, you know, there's nothing about optimization which takes the focus on cost away, because it takes the focus on cost, but you still need the cost, because, you know, one of the inputs into whether a price is optimal or not is going to be how much it's costing you. So, but I think there is a concern that, you know, it's just, you know, you're just not paying as much attention to it, so there might be some slippage there. And, you know, the European companies have done this optimal pricing for some years. And, you know, there hasn't been any problems coming out of that market. So, if you know, that might be a place to kind of monitor that, because if there are issues with that, you might see it out of that market. And I think the other focus is that, you know, the hard market, which of course we're not in right now in personal auto, you know, you're going to see a focus return to cost if that happens. And it's kind of interesting because this optimized pricing is being introduced sort of simultaneously into the insurance industry and the banking industry at the same time. and I have not done much work on the banking side, of course, but what was seen was is that, you know, the banks were very interested. Oh, you know, we might, you know, we're interested in looking at this and doing a program, and and for them, optimal pricing was like mostly concerned things like loan rates and things like that. So you might like have optimal pricing for mortgages or something like that, and then or any other type of loan. And then as soon as that subprime thing hit, and that hit the market. Interest totally gone. You know, they were back on figuring out, you know, what they had on the books. They needed to figure out. They didn't care about optimizing it. They wanted to know what the cost is. So I think that would shake up this thing. And I think what would happen is that, you know, if all of a sudden some event happened and you didn't really understand what was going on, then you sort of focus back on costs. And then this was an argument that a actuary gave me, and I thought this was pretty interesting. And they said simply, you know, this is what I want to do. I want to maximize my policies in force. But I don't want to take any policies below the cost of capital. And so what that would mean is basically this company, for an example, you know, they're charging a 4%, you know, they have rates that have a 4% underwriting profit, and that equals a 15% return on equity or something like that. And risk adjusted, that might be the same as a 6%, you know, risk-free rate, and that equals what you can get from a bond. So the idea being is that if you can't write a policy at 15% ROE, then really you're not doing anybody any favor. You need to just price it at that level. You don't need to underprice. And then the argument against overpricing is that, you know, you're not going to sell as many policies if you're taking some of them and overpricing them over the long term. Notice that he didn't say he wanted to maximize profit. He wanted to maximize policies in force. So what's kind of the answer to that? Well, that argument actually works if you're in an environment where the costs are 100% variable. But one of the things about optimization that's critical is fixed expenses. And you need to determine the amount of fixed expenses that are fixed over the policy term. And you want to absolutely just throw those out because they really have no bearing on the pricing. If you're going to spend... here's an example I gave. If you're going to spend 10% of last year's premium next year and you need to price to a 4% underwriting profit, then you can now price a policy to a minus 6% underwriting profit and still make your return on capital because you've already spent that 10%. Now, that doesn't mean you price every policy to a minus 6%, but the example that I like to think of is like it's December 31st and that last policy is coming in the door that you could write for this year. And it's coming in at a net minus 6% underwriting profit, and it's, you know, do you take it or not? And the answer would be yes. I mean, you've already spent the money. There's nothing. There's, you know, that money is spent. It has no bearing on the volume. And so, you know, so that's an answer for why some policies could be priced below the cost of capital. Now, of course, I think that's, you know, determining that an expense is fixed is a debatable point, and over the long term, a lot of these quote fixed expenses will become variable. So, don't have all the answers to that one, but here's just an example of a class plan, and basically modifying some of the relativities here. And I think kind of the story behind this slide is that really a lot of what optimized pricing is formalizing what we're currently doing. I mean, we've always done things away from just the simple rate indication because you've done a rate indication and you haven't taken it. Well, why haven't you taken it? Well, probably the biggest reason you haven't taken it is because of the competition. Or another reason is stability, because all things being equal, if you just know that it's not a great idea to raise your rates 30%. And so you may say, I'm just going to raise them 15%. Just for the idea of keeping prices stable. You didn't necessarily go out and do a mathematical model on what the impact of that would be, but you know you're doing it. And so really this is not anything new as much as it is just the idea of, hey, let's maybe model some of this stuff. Maybe let's model the stability and let's model the competition. Yeah, and we talked about this a little bit too, other than it's just interesting that, you know, here's your frontier. In this case, we're looking at earnings versus retention. And so, as Claudine pointed out, You know, you can move to this frontier, and you can either, you know, you could either keep your earnings the same and increase your retention, i.e., increase your volume, or move to the right and increase your earnings and keep the same retention. But regardless, there's a whole range of there's sort of a triangle there, and there's a whole range of pricing opportunities that are better than what you're currently doing. And you can see, just for, you know, a base rate change, what would that do? Well, that would increase your earnings, but it's going to obviously lower your retention. So let's talk about regulation a little bit and some of the potential issues with that. This is coming to us kind of from over the pond, because the process began in Europe and Israel, where there's little rate regulation. So the pricing there has been done similar to how it's been done in other industries. We talked about commercial lines, and the fact is it might be easier to implement in commercial lines because you don't have quite as defined of a rating plan. It might even be possible to bring some optimization techniques into a regulated line like workers' comp if you had related products and you optimize the related product. And then, of course, the personal lines is going to vary by state. But, I mean, it is definitely true that most companies are not filing actuarially indicated rates in every cell. And what I mean is that it's basically for every risk. And that's for a variety of reasons. We talked about the renewals versus new business. So in that case, if you have a rating plan that doesn't differentiate between renewals and new business right now, then you're sort of just ignoring a classification that you could be making. Then there's also, of course, credibility, the competitive issues, and then rate stability. And then, as I mentioned, it's really just a tool that can assist you in making that rating judgment. And in some ways, it's formalizing what you're already doing. And then as far as regulation, with certain exceptions, you know, obviously like California is an example, a heavily regulated environment, they really, you know, California, they really get into the whole, you know, how do you, you know, do your class plan, and, you know, you need to calculate your factors this way and that kind of stuff. But, you know, in general, you know, for the most part, rate regulation is pretty much done at the program level. That's kind of the level where regulators are most comfortable. They are looking at factors and things like that, but that's where their main focus is. But really, that's not as big of a concern with optimization, because optimization is at the individual rate level. And it's kind of interesting, maybe just to talk a little bit about the travel industry, because it's one that I think we're all familiar with in terms of being optimized, and I'm sure everybody has an experience where they were felt like that they were paid more than what they needed to pay or something like that. So why is that happening, and what are some of the differences? Well, what you're seeing is, you know, you're going to have more elastic demand in travel than insurance due to what I talked about earlier, and that's the simple of is that, you know, there's an ease of substitution. You can fly different airlines. Now, of course, you may not be able to get that nonstop flight, and you may not be able to, and there may be certain routes, so, you know, it's going to be different. But, I mean, of course, the airlines are very on top of that, and they know where the points are. And so I think that's one reason why you would never see the pricing optimization have the same effect, is because that demand, it's so easier to switch in the travel industry. And then probably another huge difference is the cost structure. The travel industry is built on the idea that when the plane leaves, if it's not completely full, then they've lost the money for the empty seats. Other than they didn't have to sit next to me, so that's probably worth a little bit of money. But if you've got an industry that has high variable costs, which of course the insurance industry does, because one less policy means you don't have the losses associated with the policy, you don't have to pay commissions for the policy, and you don't have to pay the taxes on the policy. And then the supply issue. You know, supply in the insurance industry is really, we're able to supply the industry, you know, at the appropriate price level. You know, there will be supply that, you know, companies have enough capital to support the business. They don't have enough capital, additional capital can be found and fairly easily brought into the marketplace through reinsurance and other mechanisms. But for example, New York hotels, you know, there's a very constrained supply of those. And interestingly enough, kind of the phenomenon in New York until was that you would see that the New York hotel rates have constrained supply of those. And interestingly enough, kind of the phenomenon in New York New York hotel rates have risen substantially since September 11th as demand has come up, but they were still converting them into condos. You know, so even with that kind of constraint, you know, the supply even got more constrained because there was even better financial opportunities for the hotel operators. So that kind of issue doesn't exist in the insurance industry. Okay, some final thoughts. I think that, you know, people like optimized prices, at least in the travel industry they do. And you're not seeing people clamor for the fact that they want, you know, everybody to pay the same for, charge the same to everyone for every route. I mean, you know, there's sort of a feeling that, you know, business travelers, people on short notice should pay more. So, and I think what optimization can do for the insurance industry is, it's certainly not a, you know, there's still an affordability issue with insurance, and there's still a lot of people that are not buying it. And, you know, I think as insurance professionals, we want to make insurance available. And what optimization can do is that, you know, what you see is when you do the optimization is that, you know, the people that can afford insurance the least, they're the people that shop the most, they're the people that get the lowest prices under the plan. So it sort of is an affordability issue. It can allow prices to be lower for people who could least afford to pay. And you see that in the plans. You see things like that the prices for low credit scores have been, while of course for rates they're very high, but when you turn to the optimization part, you know, that would indicate you need to temper that because people with the lowest credit scores tend to be the most price sensitive. We mentioned how it was still entrenched in Europe. Yeah. And then, you know, of course in the U.S. it's still very early. And you know, I think what you're going to see is you know, the early adopters are going to come in, potentially make a lot of money. And, you know, there was this thing called Credit Score that started around 1990. And there was this company in Ohio that starts with a P. It wasn't conservative. And they did a lot of credit scoring. And they really became a major player in the industry over a period of about 10 years. And it was largely, not just credit scoring, but largely due to credit scoring. But I think there's really a fundamental difference between this and credit scoring. And that's that really credit scoring, and this is why optimization could even be bigger than credit scoring. Because credit scoring, if you think about it, it's a kind of revenue neutral thing. Sure, the early adopters came in and they made a lot of money. But what did they do? They cost the people that weren't credit scoring a lot of money. They basically sucked the good risks out of the market. And so then now, where you have an environment where virtually everyone is credit scoring, we're just back to square one, you know? It's like, that's just another rating variable. And it's a valid rating variable, and it will continue. But it's not like a great money maker. If you develop a new program now, you can't be like, I'm going to use credit scoring and make a lot of money, you know? Because everybody's using credit scoring. You just have to use it. It's just another thing you have to stick in. But price optimization doesn't depend on your competitors. I mean, you might do better in the beginning if you can kind of optimize prices and other people are and take advantage of marketing opportunities. But the same point is, like, if you're optimizing prices, it doesn't matter if everybody in the world's optimizing prices. You're still going to do better than you were doing before. So it's really sort of a potential to kind of lift the profitability of the industry to some degree. And I think you're seeing, you know, the regulatory impact is unclear, but the benefit of optimization has been so strong in Europe, and the amount of money that companies are making by optimizing has been on the order of 2 to 5 points. I mean, literally taking combined ratios from 98 to, you know, 93 to 96. You know, I have to tell you, that's a lot of money, and that's huge. And I don't think, well, you know, because of the whole issues with the United States and the regulatory environment, we're not going to see that kind of benefit here. But it's only going to take a fraction of that to make this kind of process catch on and be worthwhile. So hopefully I left some time for questions. That's all I have.
Thank you, Lee. We do have some time for questions, so I'll open it up to the floor and ask, what questions do you have? Yes, sir.
Trying to model new business, price elasticity, which you discussed. I'm a little unclear on what type of data that would input in that sort of model, because it seems a new customer doesn't know or care what your price change is. They only know the price itself.
We can probably all add insights to that. You're obviously modeling on a database of quotes, which is not something every company retains once the risk stays or goes. You could be collecting the price that they were paying with the prior carrier. So in that sense, that consumer is facing a price change, though it's not one your company has given, you know, from last year to this year. But in that sense, it's probably just a general competitive position that has the most important consideration. Alice or Lee?
Right. It's basically the same thing. I mean, what you're looking at is, okay, when I offered this quote in this competitive position, what did the close rate look like for that fairly narrow market segment? Okay, and over time you notice different points like that, so you can say, okay, if I'm here now, if I cut the rates 5%, I ought to see this kind of improvement in my data. But you've got to know the competitive position. That's what's important in that situation. Though you can still have people who are very price inelastic. Maybe you can't get more lift. All the ones I'm getting, they came to me because they heard my service was great, and it's not about price. But most new markets, price is a big consideration.
To add that it's, you know, it's very difficult sometimes to get clean data on that, because what you see is that if your agents are collecting that data, it's just so dirty. I mean, unless you have a, you know, nice formal process about doing that, because, you know, somebody calls in and they give a quote and they're like, you know, well, I don't like that price, and they hang up, and, you know, it just never gets entered in the system. Or what you see a lot is that people call in, you know, I'm thinking about buying that Cadillac, and let me see what's the insurance on that. And that may get entered in as a potentially like a quote that you lost when it came over later as an endorsement. So it's just, it's more than just sort of gathering up sort of some statistics from your call centers or your agents. Or your agencies. I'll use this mic.
Any other questions?
Yes, sir. This has been pretty personalized oriented. Some of the people began to get into the fact of how things change when you move over towards commercial lines. Since I've been in reinsurance for 20 years, I'm way off the cliff. So I guess I'd like to agree or disagree, get back from the panel as to how these behavioral things become more and more important as you get further away from personal lines. For instance, when I was with Company S, a nice primary company with famous actuaries, we had special plans because we were the hardware Men's Mutual originally, and we had True Value Hardware, and we had very, very special situations. We also knew when we were up against a company in Boston, they would never give up a renewal. This is in the 80s I'm talking about, Jurassic Park days. But those sorts of forces are still probably at work. For instance, in reinsurance, it's very common, I'm not giving away any industry secrets. Company S, the French company S, was always very happy to take 1% of 100 million excess 100 million at a losing rate, so they could get 50% of 1 million excess 1 million and make 10, you know, make all kinds of a fortune, thinking that, you know, I determined the rating on that layer was tremendous. So do you agree that those sorts of factors become more and more important as you go from highly regulated personal lines through commercial lines, away from regulation, out into the jungle of reinsurance?
Yes.
Yes.
I mean,
just another slide. I just wanted to add one more slide.
The idea of kind of formally modeling, the idea of formally modeling optimization really doesn't apply if you have a unique situation. You know, it just doesn't. So you think you move more to this behavioral thing.
But you do bring up an interesting point in commercial lines in general, that maybe you need to be optimizing across multiple products, because what that business account is really looking at is not just their workers' comp price, but it's their GL and, you know, whatever else they bring to the table.
Business, quote unquote, and those loss ratios, of course, were always horrible. But we were making
thank you for your thoughts. And with that, I think we are out of time, but I would like to give a large round of applause to our three panelists, if you will. And of course, as just a reminder, please fill out your evaluation forms. Right now is the time for breaking for lunch from 11:30 to 1. And